Let me introduce Rabbi Leder. The topic for our fourth annual pre-holiday program is More Money Than God, Living a Rich Life Without Losing Your Soul. And after receiving his degree in writing and graduating cum laude from Northwestern, then studying at Trinity College in Oxford, Rabbi Leder spent 5 years studying at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion in Cincinnati. He received a master's degree in Hebrew Letters and Rabbinical Ordination in 1987. And currently serves as senior rabbi at Wilshire Boulevard Temple, a large and prestigious synagogue in Los Angeles. There's a lot more to say about Rabbi Leder, but I'm going to try get out of the way and let Rabbi Leder talk. His background is on the card that you all received. I do urge you all to buy Rabbi Leder's book, More Money Than God. We get a discount, and we just pass it along to all of you because we want you to have books in the community. So if you haven't purchased a book yet, we'll be selling them on the way out, and Debbie has a bunch left, about half the books we started with in the back. Please feel free to see Debbie Jankowski and buy your book. And Rabbi Leder, would you mind staying back to sign them? Okay, Rabbi Leder, it's yours. Thank you all, and I'll talk to you after the program.
Thank you, Ari. Thank you all for being here in the middle of a great tennis match. So I know it wasn't easy, so I appreciate the sacrifice. So it's funny, I received this the other day before coming down here to give this talk, and I thought it might be the perfect thing to begin with. It comes from Land Rover, and here it says, many things qualify one as an expert. For example, the vehicle they drive. You open it up, and it says, we invite you to join us. I'm not making this up. We invite you to join us for an exceptional 3-hour experience designed to stimulate your senses, expand your mind, and feed your soul. Wow. Not making this up. So this is the world we live in. This is the world in which we try to raise decent children and grandchildren. It is a world in which the belief in the material has almost entirely eclipsed the belief in the spiritual. It is no great insight on my part that money and the material world has become the chief idol of our culture. I find it ironic and telling that we have an interesting little phrase printed on the back of our dollar bills, which is, in God we trust. It's funny where we chose to print that, isn't it? And just as a small example of the way in which the material has supplanted the spiritual in our lives, try this little exercise with me. Take any advertising slogan you can think of and remove the name of the product and put the name God in there instead of the product. Okay? Try it. Like a good neighbor, God is there. You're in good hands with take out Coke. God, it's the real thing. Got God? God, just do it. God, a better idea. I could do nothing but for the rest of the lecture. And that is a small example of the degree to which money and the material world has become an idol. Now, for those of us, myself included, who spend a good deal of our time trying to make money, let me say this right now. Neither I nor the book are intended or intending to be disparaging of money. Money is not necessarily a good thing and not necessarily a bad thing. Money by itself is actually neutral. There are many things in our lives which are neutral and dependent entirely upon how we employ them for their goodness or evil. Nuclear medicine and nuclear warfare stem from the same science. The sun. Sun can be a marvelous thing. The sun can give you cancer and kill you. And money is no different. And I don't mean to be disparaging of money, because money is a very important and powerful tool. But only if used wisely. And that's a difficult thing in our culture. There are a lot of reasons why money is an idol. Money is an idol because it's an excellent, excellent fake. It's an excellent false god. If I were sitting down to invent a false god, I would have invented money. Why? Because money has real power. And it has much of the power that our ancestors, yours and mine, ascribed to deity, to God. Money can heal you. Try being sick in this country without money. Money can protect you. As we all witnessed on CNN over the past 10 or 12 days, there weren't a lot of wealthy people standing in line at the Superdome. It was like the Titanic, remember? Remember that song when we were kids? So they put them down below where they were the first to go. The poor always suffer more than the rich. So money can protect you. Money can heal you. Money can keep you safe. I mean, those alarm pads cost money. These gated communities cost money. And money can educate your children. Money has real power. And that's why it's such an excellent false god. But money does not have any kind of deep spiritual power. And if you were to ask me, in interviewing all the people I've interviewed for this book, and all I learned in writing it, there were two major, major mistakes that people create and fall prey to vis-a-vis money. And the first of which is this idea that the material somehow is spiritual. That our outer lives, what we have, actually says anything about who we are. The people I interviewed who got into real trouble with money, many of them got into trouble because they started to believe that their outer life actually was their inner life. The philosopher Jacob Needleman equates this to a person who tries to eat a picture of food, mistaking an imitation for what's real. And that's hard. It's hard because we and our children are bombarded day after day, minute after minute, commercial after commercial. I just read they're going to sell ads now on horse jockeys' tuchuses. You're going to be able to... Right? Right? It is difficult to escape the message that our outer lives can offer us rich inner lives. You know, I stand in line at the supermarket and I look at the women at the checkout lane looking at the covers of the women's magazines. And I wonder what they're thinking, measuring themselves against this false airbrushed semblance of perfection. And I look at men looking at the men's magazines with perfect abs or $1 billion. Men, I look at men measuring themselves against these unreal standards of perfection. And we all fall prey to it. Let me just give you an example. Actually, I should have done this earlier. Before I go any further, it was my mistake. Because I'm not sure that all of you know each other. And I know very few of you, but I'm I doubt that all of you know each other. So if you would, for just a moment, we don't have a lot of time, just take a minute. And I'd like you to just take a second and turn to a person alongside you, in front of you, behind you, that you don't know. And just take a second and just share your net worth with each other, okay? Go ahead, we got a minute. Take your time. Okay. All right. Now, time out. The scary thing is when a husband thinks he's going to have to tell his wife what his net worth is. A stranger, maybe. Now, look. Why does that simple request elicit such uncomfortable laughter from all of us? Why does that make us so uncomfortable? Well, I would suggest the reason is that every one of us, every single one of us, because of the culture in which we live, no matter how down to earth, how menschy, how decent, how balanced we may be, every single one of us, because we can't help it, has fallen prey at least a little bit to the idea that our net worth and our self-worth are somehow related. If Ari and I were standing in the back and Ed walked by and I said to Ari, what's he worth? Ari's mind is going to go exactly where all of your minds just went. We can't help it. We all know what's being asked when someone asks of another in our society, what's he worth? Do you know what she's worth? And yet, if we can step back from that reality for just a moment, we also know better. We also know when we're our best selves that a person's worth has nothing to do with how much money he or she has. But that's not where our minds go instinctively. We can't help it. So this book, More Money Than God, is an attempt to help us have a better perspective on our own reality. One of my favorite quotes is from Santayana, who said, I don't know who discovered water, but it wasn't the fish. And what he meant is that we are so much a part of our own reality that we have no perspective on it. When does a fish discover water? When it's out, when it's flailing and gasping on the bank. Those of you who have heard me before know I never have less than three or four fishing references in any talk because it's my first love. Second, actually. Money's my friend. I'm kidding. So this is an attempt to pull out of this reality and look at our own lives for a moment or two to gain some perspective. And if that is not what the High Holy Days is all about, I don't know what it is. On the High Holy Days, we're supposed to do something called Cheshbon HaNefesh, an accounting of our souls. So let's step out a little bit and look at our world and our lives. Let's talk first about this outer and inner life issue. Here's what happens when you confuse your outer life for an inner life, the material for the spiritual. I interviewed a lot of people who went to jail because of money when I wrote this book. And one guy went to jail because he had what he called a macher complex, a big shot complex. He was addicted to being a big shot. And he went to prison for kiting checks to feed his addiction. And he said something quite chilling to me. He said to me, Steve, instant gratification wasn't quick enough for me. Instant gratification wasn't quick enough for me. So now I watch my 13-year-old daughter watch TV, and what do I see? Extreme makeover. Queer eye for the straight guy. Decorating on a dime. shopping with the rich and famous. Cribs, which is going into young, overpaid Hollywood stars' homes and seeing all the bling that they have. Pimp My Ride. And on and on and on it goes. Two rich girls on a farm making fun of people who work for a living. And if you think about it, what is the subtext of all of these shows that your children and grandchildren and my children are exposed to? What is the subtext of a show like Extreme Makeover? The subtext, unspoken but omnipresent, is the message that by changing your outer life, you will change your inner life. And that is a lie. An absolute, total lie. And I would dare say that those poor souls who lost everything in Katrina know it's a lie. That stuff has nothing to do with a true inner life. So let's now talk about our children. Raise your hand if you're willing to share a story with me, okay? I want you to think back to your earliest childhood memory of money. Your very first experience or encounter or memory that involves money. And just raise your hand if you're willing to tell the story. Rhea.
My grandmother gave me a nickel. And I put it in my mouth, and she said, don't suck on it, because you'll swallow it.
What was the real message from your grandmother about that? No, I know, but what did you learn from that? Money can hurt you. Okay. Bernard, people call you Bernie?
Barney.
Oh, that's cool. I never met a Jew named Bernard who really goes by Bernard. It's always Bud, Bernie, Bunny. Okay, so, Barney.
No, I forgot what I was going to say.
Oh, you did. Okay.
No, I remember my dad would always use formulas. He says, if you're thinking of buying something, he says, how much does it cost and how often will you use it?
How much does it cost and how often will you use it? And how'd that make you feel when you were a little boy?
Sort of frustrated.
Frustrated. Okay, anybody else have a story? Tell us your name.
Polly Sloan. In the South, where I lived for a little while, and we were at my grandma's, my brother and I were allowed to set up a stand where we sold Coca-Cola. And it was the first time I ever earned any money. And I really felt good because we saw the money coming in, and all we did was handed out the Coca-Cola. It didn't last very long. But it was a wonderful feeling during the time that I was making money.
You got a rush from making money, huh? Powerful. You liked it. Easy. Easy. Did you buy the Coke?
No.
Right? She had no overhead. And the money came rolling in. Beautiful. Who wouldn't want that business? Right? Okay. One or two more.
I came from a poor family, but we also had a great-grandfather that came to die in Israel, and he would give us Hanukkah geld, or whatever we had. My parents told us, you save half of it, the other half you can use part, and the rest has to go to charity. And when I came to this country, my great-uncle told me the same thing, and I was 20 years old. So it's amazing that it was in the family from generations, I believe.
Yes. Okay. We'll do one more. I'm going to come back to that. Your name?
Mark Dresden.
Mark, yes.
My earliest recollection is Hanukkah Geld as a very, very young child. And all the relatives and neighbors would give me the Hanukkah Geld, and my parents would take it away from me. And the lesson I learned from that is not to trust my parents.
Right. Yep. Okay. So we've had four or five stories. And all but one, quite negative. My earliest association with money was, I'm one of five. I have three older sisters and a younger brother. And I found the Afikoman when I was about 4 years old. which with three older sisters was not an easy thing to do. Now, the week before, I grew up in a sort of conservadox shul in Minneapolis. And Rabbi Sachs told me the week before in nursery school, he came to nursery school, I remember he had big pillows. We put big pillows on a chair because the rabbi was coming. And it was a pretend Seder, and he got to sit on the chair with the pillows, which probably was the initial drive in my soul to become a rabbi. But he, so my brother claims anyway. So anyway, Rabbi Sachs told us that whoever finds the Afikoman gets money for it, because you cannot finish the Seder without the Afikoman. All right, so I find the Afikoman. And I go to my father. My father's a blue-collar guy, tough guy. I go to my father and I say, well, I got the Afikoman. And you can't finish the Seder without it. I'd like a dollar. My father said, this was 1964, my father said, I'll give you a quarter. I said, no, Rabbi Sachs said you can't finish the Seder without it, and I want a dollar. So he said, I'll just take this piece over here and finish with this piece instead, and now it's a dime. And I felt small and demeaned and outsmarted and manipulated by money. Money can hurt you. The thrill of money for nothing. Do you know how many kids in this country think money comes from an ATM machine? How would they know any different? Well, Aaron, we can't afford it. My son Aaron, when he was 5, we'll just go to the machine and get some more money. How would he know anything else? Money is to be taken away by parents you can't trust? Or hidden? The tooth fairy, one of the worst things we do to kids. Oh, money for nothing. Isn't that nice?
You have to grow a tooth.
You have to lose a tooth. Right? So, here's what I don't understand about Jewish parents. When our kids are learning to ride bicycles, here's what we do. First, we get them a tricycle that they can't fall off of, and we let them run around on that for a while. And then when we think they're ready, we make a big deal, and we go to Toys R Us or Target or Walmart or the bike store, and we get a nice bicycle with training wheels. And we put them on the bicycle with training wheels, and we put a helmet on their head, wrist pads, elbow pads, and knee pads. And even though the training wheels are on, we still kind of hold the seat, and we push them around a little bit. And then after a few months of that, when we think they might be ready and their balance is developed enough, we make a big deal. We take off the training wheels. Of course, a Jewish dad never has the right tool to do it. But one way or another, we get the training wheels off. And then we put them on the bicycle, and we hold the seat, and we have the helmet and the wrist pads and the elbow pads and the knee pads, and we go somewhere where there is no traffic, a parking lot, wherever. And we run behind. And we gently let them go and still run behind. We do all of that when it comes to riding a bicycle. We prepare our children so well and protect them so well before we launch them out into the world. But when it comes to money, most parents do nothing. Or worse, they do harm. And they just kind of hope it'll turn out okay. But it doesn't turn out okay. I've spoken a lot about money, and you're no exception. This group is no exception. 9 out of every 10 childhood stories about money is negative. So we need to be as thoughtful about our children's early experiences with money as we are with every other early experience. We need to talk with them about money. We need to give them experience with money. There's a lot of information in the book that I won't go into now. But I hope we can at least agree that we need to be thoughtful about it. And now how about this? Another taboo subject. It's crazy to me. You know, people will talk to each other. My wife goes to the park. She has a new best friend every week. They know everything about each other. Their hemorrhoids, their surgeries, they're sagging this, they're sagging that. They know everything about each other. Except nobody talks about money. So how many of us here have teenage children? Any of us have teenage children? Okay. No, no, we got to have children here. All right. Ayal and?
Gaila.
Okay, how old are your kids?
13.
Boy, girl.
13-year-old girl, perfect. Okay. What's her name?
Yael.
Yael. So Yael comes home, and she tells you an incredibly racist joke that she heard at school. Really vile. What are you going to do?
Well, first thing is we'll go and talk to the people at the Jewish Day School and find out how she's...
She heard it from her friend. She heard it from her friend whose father is Schwarza this and Schwarza that all day long. That's where she heard it. Now, what are you going to do about it?
We'll talk to her about the negative implications of generalizing and speaking badly about other people.
What she said, right?
It's probably, for our family, it's going to involve a discussion about racism, not just against blacks, but against Jews. Probably a trip on the internet to a few different sites. And an hour and a half later, she'll be crying from the explanations.
Okay, you're going to jump all over it, aren't you? Okay, you're not going to let it slide. All right, who else has a teenager? Anybody have a teenage boy? Okay. What's your name? Avi. I'm picking on all the Israelis today. Okay, Avi, how old's your boy?
17.
Perfect. What's his name?
Ben.
Ben. So Ben comes home, and is Ben's mother around? Okay. What's her name?
Osnat.
So Ben comes home, and he says to Osnat, his mother, he tells her, as my 16-year-old did a few weeks ago, an incredibly sexist joke, misogynistic, anti-woman joke, because he thinks it's going to be funny. Okay? What is Osnat going to say to Ben?
Well, first he will tell it to me and not to his mother. You know that?
That's why I didn't set it up that way.
Then we discuss how to water it down to tell his mother. And if it's good enough, we write it down and we put it on the internet. So,
wrong guy. Wrong guy. Let's pick somebody else who has a teenage. You reprobate. What's your name?
Me?
Yes.
Susan.
Susan. Do you have kids?
I do.
How old?
3 and 7.
Okay, your 7-year-old is a boy or girl?
Girl.
Oh, shoot.
Sorry.
Okay, how about this?
Boys.
You have boys?
Boys?
Kathy, right?
Kathleen,
you have boys. How old are your boys?
11 and 9.
Okay, your 11-year-old comes home. Your 11-year-old son comes home and says, hey, mommy, why do women have breasts? And you say, I don't know why. And he says, so there's something to look at while they're talking.
He'd hear it.
What would he hear from you, Kathleen?
That's not acceptable, that you don't, women's body parts are not objects, you don't talk about them that way, and that they have a function, and we would talk about the function, and depending on the situation, he might have to write about why that's not okay.
Right, and maybe it would go something like, that's demeaning to me, it's demeaning to your aunties, it's demeaning to your grandmothers, it's wrong. We would jump all over it. Okay. Just kidding. Okay. All right. Now, tell me your name again. Susan. Susan. 3 and 7?
Yeah.
7-year-old girl, right? What's her name?
Emma.
Emma. Okay. So now Emma comes home and says, Mommy, Eve's daddy has 5 cars. What is Susan going to say?
I'm happy for him.
Okay. All right. Okay, good. All right. So, Susan has a few choices. She can say, wow, that's great. This happened when my daughter was 5. She came home from a school called the Center for Early Education, which I call the Center for Early Materialism. or the Center for Early Extortion. And she said this to me, Daddy, Evie's daddy has 5 cars. Now, I had some choices, like Susan has choices. Like you have choices. Like you have choices. I can say, really? Wow, that's fantastic. What are they? Or I can say nothing. Sort of like, oh, that's nice. Kids learning to play the drums up there. Or I can weigh in. The way I weigh in on racism and the way I weigh in on sexism. I can say something like, Hannah, how many cars can a person drive at one time? And then, you know, I'll get the right answer with the teenage eye roll. You know that eye roll, like, oh, could you possibly be more embarrassing to me? Oh, right? But nevertheless, I'll hang in there. How many cars can one person drive at one time, Hannah? 1. Well, Hannah, let's figure out what these other 4 cars cost. And let's add that up. And then let's try and figure out how many homeless people we could feed for a year with what those 4 cars cost. And no, Hannah, I can't afford 5 cars. But even if I could, I wouldn't, because I don't think it's appropriate. Now, that is a conversation that most parents are unwilling to have with their children. And I can only ask the question, why is racism wrong and why is sexism wrong, but materialism is just fine, thank you very much? I don't understand that. And we need to weigh in. And you have a right to speak. And yes, there's a risk that it will get back to Evie's daddy, that Hannah's daddy thinks he's a materialistic chaser. Yes. But you don't care if it gets back to whosoever daddy that you think racism is wrong, and you don't care that it gets back to whosoever daddy that sexism is wrong. Why are we so afraid to comment and weigh in? These are our children. If they don't have us to help interpret this insane world of materialism in which they live, if we will not help them navigate those waters, who will? MTV? The Gap? Juicy Couture? Who will help them if not us? And now let's be honest and turn the lens on our own special Jewish community. Okay, I am an anthropologist. I am a non-Jewish anthropologist, and I am studying the tribe. Wow, these are fancy. I don't know. I don't know which end. They don't work. Well, let me see. There, I got it. Okay. Wow. Okay. So, I am a non-Jewish anthropologist. What's the big university down here? UCI. UC Irvine, is that it? Okay. I am getting my PhD in anthropology from UCI. Non-Jew. But my anthropology, my PhD thesis is on the values of the tribe known as the Jews. And so, I'm going to go to... I know the only shul name I know down here is Bat Yam. So I'm going to go to Bat Yam on Shabbat morning. All right. That's the one I wouldn't set foot in. I know. All right. I'm going there because I have 5 cars. I heard somebody else said that, not me. All right. Shabbat morning, bar mitzvah. Let's not call it Bat Yam. It's too partisan down here. I can already see you people don't get along with each other. The fewer Jews, the more shuls. I don't understand it. All right. Okay. 2 Jews walk into a bar, and they buy it. All right. Just kidding. All right. So, now, in all seriousness, so I'm getting my PhD, and I'm going to Temple whatever. Temple Shalom. I don't know if there is one, but... There is there? Those are usually spin-offs from a very fractious fight that took place at some point, and there's always this self-righteous group that walks away and says, well, we're going to call ourselves Temple Shalom. I know. All right. Temple Torah. Let's call Temple Torah so nobody gets hurt here. I'm there on Shabbat morning to watch a bar bat mitzvah What are the values that I'm going to see, that I'm going to discern as belonging to the tribe known as the Jews? And these are, for real, what am I going to see there? Some pretty amazing things. Mark? No. Shabbat morning. Hold on. Shabbat morning on the Bima. On the Bima. See, we're hard on ourselves. We shouldn't be so hard on ourselves. What am I going to see Shabbat morning on the Bima? Any shul. I'm going to see a kid chanting from the Torah. Am I not? Okay. I'm going to see Torah. I'm going to see, what else? Is the kid only chanting Torah? Haftarah. Haftarah. I'm going to see learning. I'm going to see a drash. Going to see family. Somebody said davening. I'm going to see prayer. Am I going to hear some beautiful music, some spiritual music? Spiritual music. I'm going to see clergy. Community, absolutely. I'm going to see all those things. And these are beautiful values. Often you'll see a grandparent hand the Torah to a parent, to the child. I mean, I do them every week. I know. I'm always moved. Always moved. And we can be very proud of these values. Now, same group of Jews, same day, just a few hours later. What are the values the anthropologist would discern or distill as being those of the Jewish people at your average Saturday night bar bat mitzvah soiree? Food. Do you mean gluttony or do you mean food? Depends on the person. Okay. So eating would be a Jewish value. Loud music. Is it like a loud version of Avinu Malkeinu or loud rap music, secular, misogynistic, materialistic, hip-hop? No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. Could just be rock and roll. Yeah, disco, Motown. Could be Jewish. Keep dreaming. It always amazes me when I see on the Bima in the morning talking about how we honor our elders, and then I see the grandparents Saturday night like this. Because they can't hear anything. Okay, loud music. Somebody said gluttony, I think. Excess. Can we say gross excess? Gross excess. No, I'm saying it the average one, not the exception. Just your average bar bat mitzvah part. Yeah, have you seen, when you say outfits, I think, Ari, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're talking about a pretty sexually charged environment, right? Have you seen these 13-year-old girls in their slinky, strapless black dresses and the totally bewildered 13-year-old boys looking up at them like, yeah, these are very, very sexually charged. The dancing, the professional dancers. I always see these women, these professional dancers, dancing, you know, trying to get the 13-year-old boys worked up. And I just think, wow, where am I? What is this, a Fellini movie? I know it's not as bad here as it is in L.A., but I've been at a few where the Laker girls come out. I'm expecting the dads to start handing out dollar bills to the boys so they can stuff them in their outfits. Can I assure you, if it's L.A. today, it's Orange County tomorrow. I promise you. Because I've been all over the country talking about this. It's the North Shore of Chicago. It is. Believe me. It's Minneapolis, it's the North Shore of Chicago, it's St. Louis, it's Kansas City, it's Seattle. It's everywhere there's money, and everywhere people believe that their net worth and their self-worth are somehow related. A lot of alcohol at these things, a lot of drinking. By the way, I've done an exhaustive study of the sources. Nowhere is it written anywhere that one must have hard liquor at a bar bat mitzvah party. Most Jewish alcoholics will tell you that their alcoholism began when they were 13, making the bar mitzvah party circuit. They were the kid finishing the adults' drinks, let the adults leave behind on the table when they get up to dance. They were the kid chugging the Manischewitz at the Kiddush while everybody laughed and thought it was cute. Yeah. Go ahead. Elliot.
One thing that's positive that I see, because I've seen what comes 2 or 3 years later, is the intergenerational dancing that does take place.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I'll repeat it. Yeah, it's not all bad.
Because if you walk in when they're ninth grade and they walk into a high school dance, it's much, much worse.
Yeah, listen. It's not all bad. There are some nice things that happen, too. And by the way, don't get me wrong. I'm not Amish. I like a nice party. I like a nice glass of wine. I love good food. But I think we can all agree that we are not at our best as a people on the Saturday night side of the board. It's not all bad. There's tzedakah often. There's all kinds of nice things. Some people begin with Havdalah. Yes, there's a lot of apologetics that can be made. There are. There are positive things, but in my view, they don't excuse the negative things. They merely make it less negative. And I know it's hard to face this. I give this talk to every family. We have 170 a year. I meet with all 170 of them, and I do this in front of the kids. And I say to the parents, I don't care what your kids want, because you're in charge. You're paying. And you don't have many more years to sit down with your children and say, this is what our family believes is appropriate. We don't care what the other families do. This is what we believe is appropriate. And now I know the next question. Well, gee, Rabbi, one person's appropriate is another person's gross excess. How much is too much? And that's a reasonable question, to which I can give a fairly unsatisfying answer. But it's the truth. Any lawyers here? All right, so I'm going to say this to you, you'll understand it. Potter Stewart. When Justice Potter Stewart was asked to define obscenity for the Supreme Court, here's what he said. I can't define it, but I know when I see it. You're asking me to define gross excess, and I can only say to you, neither I nor you can define it, but both I and you know it when we see it. So, we need to be thoughtful about our children. But now what about us? Are there any sex addicts here today? Please raise your hand. Any sex addicts here? Are there any drug addicts here? Pill heads, pot heads? Anybody? Last chance, Elliot. Anybody here with a gambling addiction? Wow. Any alcoholics? Anybody here currently or in the past suffer from workaholism? Any workaholics here? If you tell the truth, raise your hand if you're a former or current workaholic. Great. Okay. Why is workaholism the last acceptable ism in the Jewish world? In fact, we're not even ashamed of it. We raise our hands with glee. Oh, yeah, that's me. That's me. I'm the workaholic right here. Rabbi. Him. He's the workaholic. Look, Rabbi, he's... We have one. We have one in our family. It's not Jewish. It's not Jewish to be a workaholic. You see, because you really can't have it all. You can't have it all. You can't be... Well, let me put it differently. Here's how my friend Eddie Feinstein puts it. He says there's this calculus about life. You can be a good lawyer, a good doctor, a good secretary, a good teacher, a good electrician, and a great husband or wife, and a great parent, a great father and mother. But you can't be great. You can't be a great doctor, a great lawyer, a great rabbi, a great teacher, and a great spouse and great parent. Something has to give. And usually what gives is time for our marriage and our children. And it is not the Jewish way. And we have our own antidotes. We have our own antidotes. I have a hard time getting people in my shul to take Shabbat seriously, but anytime I walk into a room and say, who would like an additional 7 weeks of vacation every year? Who here would like an additional 7 weeks off every year? Raise your hand. Seriously, if you'd like another 7 weeks off every year. Guess what? Shabbat, 52 days. It's about 7 weeks. A little more, actually. It's ours by birthright. And Maimonides, 800 years ago, made a fascinating observation about the world that God created for us. Maimonides talks about three sources or reasons for evil. And without going too much into it, let me just say the first thing he identifies, these are all attempts to let God off the hook for evil, by the way. The first, he says, is the evil that isn't really evil, we just think it is, which is that we fall apart. Because we're made of flesh and blood, we fall apart. Some of us more quickly, some of us more slowly, but we all fall apart because that's what it means to be made of flesh and blood. That's what it means to be a person. The day I turned 40, my left knee started to hurt. That day. I don't know. 5 years ago, I took no pills every day. Now I take five a day. Niaspan, Lipitor, baby aspirin, Asiflex, and a vitamin. God knows where it's heading. But that isn't evil. That's just what it means to be a human being. If you don't want to fall apart, then you should choose to be an inanimate object, like a chair or a stone. If you want to act on nature, then nature's going to act on you. So the first source that people say is evil isn't even evil. It's just what it is to be a human. The second kind of evil he identifies is the evil we do to each other. Again, this is not God's fault. It has nothing to do with God. People treat each other poorly. They know better, and they ignore it. And even that, he says, is not predominant. Most of the world is not at war most of the time. And the third source of evil he identifies is the evil we do to ourselves. Why? We have a PhD in Jewish thought here, so you'll back me up. Why? The evil we do to ourselves because we eat too much, we drink too much, we want too much. That Dave Matthews song, right? Too much, too much, too much. And here's the interesting observation that the Rambam makes about the world that God created for us. He says God created a world for us which contains in greatest abundance that which we need the most. What do we need the most to live? Number one, air. No, air is first. You can go a lot longer without drinking than you can without breathing. So air, guess what? It's everywhere, it's free, it's readily available. Next is water. Also, until greed screwed up a good portion of the planet with pollution, that was also readily available and free. Next, food, right? Now, what kind of food? Al dente with the white truffle sauce? No. What kind of food? Simple, basic proteins and carbohydrates. The cheapest stuff in the grocery store. Rice, flour, an apple. No. And it's this narrowing pyramid. It's this inverted pyramid. God created in the greatest abundance what we need the most. And ironically, we spend a good part of our lives working to earn money to buy luxury items that frankly are expensive because they're rare. Why are they rare? Because we need them the least. And it becomes a treadmill. But Jews should know better. And again, I'm not disparaging money. Money's important. But so is time. A friend of mine joked that I should have called this book Rabbi Bites Hand That Feeds Him. Because, you know, the danger in talking about money, which no rabbi can afford, is that it'll piss the rich people off. And then where are you? But I'm very pleased to say it hasn't turned out that way. because these mistakes of believing you need what you merely want and spending your life for what you want instead of what you need, and these mistakes of instant gratification not being quick enough, and these mistakes of confusing our outer life with our inner life, they can happen to every one of us, no matter how much or how little money we have. And we can avoid them no matter how much or how little money we have. I want to spend just maybe five more minutes with you. And talking a little bit about Jewish business ethics and tzedakah. So, oh my God, I'm not good at these stands. So here's the thing about Martha and Enron and Kobe. For every one of them, there are a million of us who are just the same, but on a smaller scale or a darker room. You ask most people what the most shameful thing they have ever done in their lives is, and 9 times out of 10, that shameful thing will involve money. Either the sin was committed to get money, or money was used to commit the sin. It's a very powerful thing, money. So here's everything we need to know about Jewish business ethics. It comes from the Torah, Parashat Ki Tetzeh. It's the most important line in the Torah. Ki Tetzeh Lemilchama, when you go out to war, and you conquer another people, and you see among them a woman, and you want her, you must first take her to your home. You must allow her to mourn the loss of her family for 30 days. You must shave her head and pare her nails, make her unattractive. And then and only then, after that time, if you still desire her, you must marry her, make her your wife. And that's everything we need to know about Jewish business ethics. There she is on the field of battle. And I know that business is war. I grew up in a family business. That's why I'm a rabbi. I didn't have the stomach for it. I understand. I do know what most people go through to earn a living. Business is war. And there she is, and everyone's doing it anyway, and who is she anyway, and who would know? And at the moment that thought enters your mind, the Torah says, stop. Control yourself. Behave yourself. That's all we need to know about Jewish business ethics. Stop. Control yourself. These are human beings we're talking about. Oddly enough, our ancestors did not consider money to be the way in which riches were measured. Money, originally, was merely a device used by the community to uplift the poor, an easy way to transfer money to the poor so they could be taken care of. You all know the song, right? Haggadah. My father bought for 2 zuzim, Haggadah, right? Zuzim. Doctor comes from the Hebrew word, the Hebrew verb.
Lazuz.
Lazuz, which means?
Move.
To move, to circulate. That was the original, Azuz is a biblical word for coin. That was the original purpose of money. Not to be hoarded, but to be in motion as a device to uplift the poor.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to divulge of money that it will make you yourself a poor.
I didn't say it was to impoverish ourselves either. But riches were measured in numbers of wives, numbers of children, size of the flock, etc. But the actual coinage was merely a way to uplift the poor. Yes. So a word about tzedakah, and it is especially poignant. I'm going to end with this. Well, I'm going to end. This will take 5 minutes, and then I'll be glad to take a few questions and then sign books if you'd like. It's especially poignant given what we've seen on the news after this disaster. But here's the dangerous thing about Katrina. The sad thing would be if Americans believe that Katrina created all that poverty we saw on CNN. Katrina didn't create that poverty. Katrina blew the roof off of that poverty so we could take a good hard look at it. There is a third world country in every major American city, including ours. And one, I believe, would have to be absolutely blind not to have noticed a race-poverty connection in this disaster. So there's a verse in the book of Proverbs that has always troubled me. In the book of Proverbs, it says, Tzedakah tatzil mimavet. Tzedakah averts death. You'll see this, by the way. I collect old tzedakah boxes from Israel from the 30s and 40s, pre-state Israel tzedakah boxes. So if you're ever up in the middle of the night on eBay looking at tzedakah boxes, lay off, okay? I don't want to be in a dogfight at 2 in the morning with any of you. 2196. So I collect these old tzedakah boxes, and a lot of them say, tzedakah tatzil mimavet, tzedakah averts death. I mean, there's a hell of a good reason to give, right? But that verse always troubled me. Because were the rabbis really that naive? Did they really believe that tzedakah could keep us alive? I mean, all the tzedakah in the world doesn't keep the people we love alive. And by the way, they lived during a time, my goodness, when the book of Proverbs was written, life expectancy was late 20s, early 30s. You died from an abscessed tooth back then. There was no penicillin. Your kid got an earache, there was none of that bubblegum amoxicillin. They just died. A third of all women died in childbirth. There were no C-sections. There were no epidural blocks. 3 out of 4 infants didn't make it to their first birthday. So they had to know that all the generosity in the world didn't keep people alive. So what is it with this verse, tzedakah averts death? And it always bothered me till I heard this beautiful little story. I'm going to share it with you. It's a story about a pious man, his son, and his dying wife. It's Friday afternoon, and they're in the hospital, and the father says to his son, I want you to go home, prepare for Shabbos, and be sure to invite a poor person to have Shabbos dinner with us tonight. And the son is very angry with his father when he tells him to do this because he's sitting at his mother's deathbed. But he's a dutiful son. He does it anyway. Late that night, the mother dies. The next morning, the son says to his father, he says, Father, when you told me last night to go home and prepare for Shabbos and invite a poor person to the table, I was angry with you. But then I remembered the verse, tzedakah tatzil mimavet. Tzedakah averts death. And I realized you were just trying to save mama's life. To which the father replied, you're wrong. I wasn't trying to save your mother's life. It's not the lives of people we love who are saved by tzedakah. I wasn't trying to save her life. I was trying to save God's life. Because human generosity is the only thing that keeps God alive on earth. Without it, we banish God to heaven alone. So it is a holy and sacred thing to uplift another with money. And I hope that you will read the book. And I hope we will cease to be like fish in the water. And we will step back and have a more thoughtful relationship with money. And to help our children and grandchildren have a more thoughtful relationship with money. I want to conclude by just reading a tiny little bit from the book. Thanks. This is a true story, and I can actually now tell you the person's name because he has since died. Since the book came out, he's died. This is a story about John Schlesinger. Who's a very famous movie director. He directed Midnight Cowboy, Day of the Locust, a lot of great, great movies of the 60s and 70s. And this is a story about when I met him. And I'll end with this. A few years ago, I was called to see an extremely famous and wealthy movie director. He was a friend of a friend, and he was in the hospital. We were strangers, this dying old man and I. Entering his room, I noticed amid the monitors, tubes, and fluorescent lights of the sterile ICU, there was only one solitary breath of humanity tacked up on the wall. One small black and white photograph, some 60 years old, of a young couple, his parents, in their 20s, holding hands on a park bench. I entered the room, glanced at the photograph, and then focused on the balding, white-bearded man behind the oxygen mask. His name was John. With a curl of his hand hanging limply off the side of the bed, he motioned me toward him, removed his oxygen mask, and tried to speak. Too weak, he replaced the mask, closed his eyes, rested, and then tried again. Again and again he tried. A whisper, a mumble. John, I can't understand you, I told him, but I'm not leaving until I do, so rest and we'll try again in a few minutes. Finally, pulling me gently down over the bed, John pressed his dry lips against my ear and mumbled a simple question. What's it all for? Suspended in a moment, both eternal and brief, there we were. The dying seeking an answer, the answer of answers, while holding a stranger's hand. A stranger who was supposed to know. My eyes darted to the little black and white picture, then back to John, laboring for breath. And with zen-like clarity that surprised me, I uttered a response as simple as his question. It's to love and be loved, I told him. They understood that, I added, pointing to the photo. You're right, John whispered as he closed his eyes and drifted off to sleep. In a way, I felt sorry for John. With all of his success, he was dying alone, asking a stranger what life was really all about. I believe what I told him. A life well lived is filled with love given and received, the ebb and flow of time and generosity. No matter what our net worth, all of us can become rich with family, caring, and laughter. We can all invest in and achieve the wealth of friendship. We can all spend less time counting our money and more time counting our blessings. We can all lead richer lives, ever more grateful, simply to love and be loved. Thank you all for being here tonight.